let's talk and let's laugh, cause I got so much to tell you, so let's go kick some ass.
Kia ora and welcome to Kick Arts with Emma and Stephen and Kristen. Kick Arts is Aotearoa's comprehensive art show, brought to you on Planet FM 104.6 and streaming live around the globe thanks to our podcast, which you can download from planetaudio.org.nz and check us on Spotify. Tonight we are getting naked in the trees. Yes, you heard it correctly. Not yet, Logan. Put your clothes back on. It's later in the show. And we are checking in with the cast and producers of the last 5 years, and we're heading to the States to check in with Emma and a fantastic author. Now, our first guests tonight are from the show the last 5 years, so to kick off our Sunday night, here is a track from the show called Moving Too Fast.
Did I just hear an alarm start ringing? Did I see sirens go flying past? Though I don't know what tomorrow's bringing, got a singular impression things are moving too fast. I'm gliding smooth as a figure skater. I'm riding hot as a rocket blast. I just expected it 10 years later. I've got a singular impression things are moving too fast. And you say, oh no, step on the brakes, do whatever it takes to stop this train. Slow, slow, the light's turning red. But I say, no, no, whatever I do, I barrel on through and I don't complain. No matter what I try, I'm flying full speed ahead. I'm never worried to walk the wire. I won't do anything just half-assed. But with the stakes getting somewhat higher, I've got a singular impression that things are moving too fast. I found a woman I love, and I found an agent who loves me. Things might get bumpy, but some people analyze every detail. Some people stall when they can't see the trail. Some people freeze out of fear that they'll fail. But I keep rolling on. Some people can't find success with their art. Some people never feel love in their heart. Some people can't tell the two things apart. But I keep rolling on. Of riding like the high and mighty. Now I'm the subject of a bidding war. I met my personal Aphrodite. I'm doing things I never dreamed of before. We start to take the next step together. Found in a popping on 73rd. The Atlantic Monthly's printing my first chapter. $2,000 without rewriting one word. I left Columbia and I don't regret it. I wrote a book and Sonny made a red. My heart's been swollen, my ego's swollen. Got all this and more before 24. It's hard not to be sure. I'm spinning out of control. Out of control. I'm feeling panicked and rushed and hurried. I'm feeling outmaneuvered and outclassed. But I'm so happy I can't get worried about this singular impression. I've got a singular impression things are moving too fast.
Ooh, Moving Too Fast, great track from the last 5 years, and we're going to talk to the team very shortly. Welcome back, Kristen.
Oh, hello, everyone.
Great to have you here. I'm very jealous, though. Emma's posts of all the shows she is seeing in the States.
She sounds so happy when you're just playing some of, you know, some of what she was talking about. And I just think you could just hear it in her voice, just in her element.
We'll catch up with her a little later in the show. I'm a bit croaky today. I've had auditions of nearly 200 teenagers in the last 48 hours, which is fantastic for the Adams family. And Emma's not here, but it's our sixth anniversary. We've done this show for 6 years this week.
Happy anniversary.
6 years. So we'll thank Emma when she comes back. Some sad news. This week we lost a comedy icon, Catherine O'Hara. You a Schitt's Creek fan?
I 100% am in an everything Catherine O'Hara fan, so this is devastating. I don't usually get so upset about it, but she was just such an inspiration to me.
And of course, we've talked Beetlejuice on the show many times. She's well known for that, and of course, the original Home Alone series. Yeah, a true icon.
She could do everything. She could go from glamour to funny to campy to just dazzling.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, speaking of dazzling, we've got a dazzling lineup in the studio tonight from the team from the last 5 years, which is on at the Pump House Theatre very soon. Welcome producers and actors Rose and Logan and director Jack. Welcome back to Kick Arts.
Hello.
Thank you for having us.
It's
thank
great you very much. To have you all here. And Logan, look, you kick it off because I made fun of you in the opening. why on earth did you decide you wanted to take on the producer hat and tackle producing and acting in it?
Yeah, so this kind of goes back a while, but maybe in 2022 I started looking at this score quite a lot because I was using a bunch of the songs for classical music competitions in like art song categories and musical theatre categories, and so I started feeling really attached to a lot of the numbers that Jamie sings and had always kind of had an inkling that I really, really wanted to be involved with this show at some point. And if we jump forward a bit, around May or June of last year, I started getting really, really keen on the idea of being able to have more creative control over the kind of production process, because I was getting to a point where I'd feel like I'd have so many ideas and so many things that I'd want to do or experiment with, and a lot of them are quite extreme, and the general response to that is almost always for people to kind of black hat these ideas because they are either quite reinventive or extreme in that sense, and then not really give it a go. And one of the things I really wanted to be able to do was to be able to throw ideas at the wall that are extreme and see when they start to actually stick, because I feel like that's when you start getting some really, really incredible like niche moments in theater, especially in the like community scene, is when people make these really bold choices or do something a different way. And when we were doing Merrily We Roll Along in June and I met all of these wonderful people, I finally realized, oh, I think I'm at a point where I have the exact people I've needed to meet.
That's cool.
To be able to start doing something like that. And so initially me and Rose were talking about putting it on, and we were talking about potentially like pitching it to theaters and stuff like that and going around the like community theater circuit seeing who would kind of green light it for us. And at some point we kind of realized that if we do that, then we are now beholden to their boards and stuff like that. And if we had potentially some ideas that are quite extreme, they might get vetoed and we wouldn't be able to properly feel like we've satisfied that creative urge. So a big part of it was being able to say, for example, bring on Jack as a director who can listen to these ideas and be like, okay, I hear you, I see what you want to do, now I'm going to try and make that actually work.
Nice.
You know, and like, and start putting it together. And I think one of the beautiful things I've noticed with this process is that that's exactly what happened. We'll bring up some ideas that are quite extreme, and Jack will look at it and be like, yeah, that's extreme, let's give it a go. And then sometimes we get to the end of these ideas and we're like, yeah, that didn't work. And sometimes we get to the end of these ideas and we're like, I can't see this any other way now.
Nice.
You know, and that's part of also where, for example, adding a dance ensemble to this show comes from, which is quite an extreme choice for the last 5 years. I'm sure a lot of people have seen that announcement and been a bit like, what? Isn't this musical a two-person show?
And check it, though.
But
yeah,
now they have to come and watch it, right? They have to see... And
good
they have
producers.
To see whether the idea is good or bad, and then once they've seen it, they can make that decision. But, well, we've definitely noticed that every single time we've gone to include them, we've taken a scene from maybe like a 50% there all the way past 100%, and suddenly you become unable to see this any other way.
Nice. So, Jack, do you have a line in your contract that says must test out all crazy creative ideas no matter what venue can veto?
I think it's just a standard sort of agreement and understanding that Logan and I have, after, like you mentioned, after doing the show together last year, we kind of got this sort of like sixth sense sort of like working with one another, and we were like able to talk freely and openly, and any collaborative idea is something that is not seen with any resistance or any like this wouldn't work. It's more like, okay, let's take this idea, what does it look like in a vacuum, let's try and apply that, and if it works, it works, and if it doesn't, well, we at least tried it, we know that it's an idea that has been tried. But yeah, it's been quite
Because it is different having the producers in the show. So often in theatre, and I've produced so many shows, I'm either sort of around and supporting, or I'm actually pretty hands-off. It's just put the dollars in, support it, do what you need to do. To actually have you in the cast is a real investment. How are you managing that sort of relationship switch? Is there sort of when they're on the stage, they're your actors, when they're off the stage, you have those conversations, or does it flow because you get on so well?
I mean, there is that level of concern that you have of like working with your friends on something that you so deeply want to invest in something, and you don't know where the lines are, but it's just been so smooth, like smooth sailing. Like the conversations we've had, it's like send a message, I've got this idea, cool, let's give that a try. It just works, which has been really refreshing. There's no resistance, there's people are able to talk openly, and that's kind of like the best thing, I think, for theatre, to be able to have a team that is able to talk so openly and not have to worry about if anyone's got, like, they're going to shoot down your ideas, they're not going to make you feel small, they're going to build you up.
Nice. So, Rose, what is it about the last 5 years that attracted you to the story and the show and the magic of it?
Well, it was Logan's proposition of doing it first. I never heard of the show. Okay. I had no idea, but I was, like, kind of new to theatre, and I was like, yeah, I'll sing this. I did listen to the score, and I had a panic attack, so I was like, this is very difficult to sing. But the more I listened to it, I was like, wow, it's so clever, and the storyline is just so heartfelt and just emotionally intense, and it was just kind of too exciting of a story to unpack to say no. And kind of like what the guys were saying, there's so much respect on the set, and everyone, I think, just kind of loves each other, which is really cool.
Nice.
So that's been part of the fun of the storytelling too, and it's kind of what's kept the like magic alive of putting it on and continuing to fall in love with the show, is that everyone is so committed to it and so excited about unpacking the characters and their journeys. And you know, because on paper it's kind of a simple story, you know.
So tell our listeners a little bit about the story.
Yeah, well, it's basically like Divorce the Musical. So pretty much like this couple kind of fall in love, and you see that journey from one character kind of goes forward in time and the other goes backwards, and they meet in the middle at their wedding. So that's kind of the climax,
that's
the middle,
right.
And it's beautiful, and then it falls apart either side. And you kind of, you know, neither of them do anything particularly crazy on paper, but there's so much nuance to the reasons that they fall apart. And I think every audience member would watch the show and be able to relate to so many different parts of the story and so many different aspects of the characters, and just kind of go, who was in the wrong? Like, who was the villain? I don't know. It's part of what makes it so beautiful, because I think you go in with such a human element to the whole thing, and it really makes you think about your own relationships and your own friendships and how life works in general and how things can fall apart. Yeah.
And so then adding an ensemble, how did that give it even more legs? Did it tell the story even more poignantly? Like, how did more people bring this story?
I can take that one if you'd like. So the show itself comprises of, I think it's about 14 songs. Each song is a different part of the story. It's a different part of the journey of both of these characters. And there's some scenes that it's the two of them together, but there's a lot of songs that, there's opportunity to add all of the people around. Like the people they're interacting with, the ones who are sort of like hyping each other up, the characters that are sort of going on in their head. Like, it just opened up the opportunity for us to look at these numbers and be like, okay, it can be more than just you stand and you sing really, really well, because the songs are very well written, but there's a lot of them that have like a lot of powerful belting, and there's a lot of like lyrical things that need to be played with vocally. So being able to add in an ensemble, it's been able to create this extra layer of storytelling. Like, for example, there's a scene that's set inside of a book shop, because Jamie is in the universe of the story is an author. The ensemble gives us the opportunity to create his mad fans, so you get to see this aspect of the scene that you wouldn't normally see. You just see him pretending to do this, but this now you're actually getting to see him have these interactions with these fans and how he reacts to that and how Kathy reacts to seeing him with his fans and all that sort of thing. So it gives those little extra elements that we can play with.
Mm. Yeah, we've also chosen dancers for their talent as dancers, and like, they don't sing in the show. There's actually a lot of our dance ensemble that are incredible singers and incredible actors, but they're also like exceptional comp level, just insane dancers. And I feel like there's such a gap in musicals where like people, all our ensembles are expected to be kind of like triple threats. And I'm like, where is the opportunity for dancers to just come on stage and be dancers and just like show off what they have? So we've kind of made sure that that's the case. The dancers don't sing. They obviously act and tell the story through their body and face, but they're dancing first and foremost, which is really cool, because I feel like it adds such a level of artistry to like this specific musical that I actually haven't seen in shows kind of anywhere. Like, you're really expected to see someone in an ensemble do all three things. This is just like really different, and it's been so fun to play with, because they're just doing tricks and like fun stuff that you wouldn't see if they were having like belt as well.
Minute you start saying that all they have to do is dance, you really open up the pool of talent to actually pull in some incredible dancers that you would never see on stage if they're being expected to be triple threats.
Yeah, and they light up. They're like, yes, I can just dance.
And how are you coping with the producing side, from, you know, having to deal with all the finances and the marketing and all of that? What new learnings have you had going into that space?
Yeah, I think a lot of the learnings I've had in regards to the production angle is kind of how much easier the entirety of the back end operation was than I thought it was.
Okay.
And I think, not saying that there's absolutely nothing to be done, and it's a very, very easy process, but just that in reality, the whole thing has been so much less daunting than I expected.
Cool.
And things like coordinating all of the like band, for example, and roping in all of the dancers and all of that, and then organizing everything on top of it and bringing in props and set and costumes has all been... When you find people who are good at the jobs they're doing, and the all of these jobs are being filled by people who are really competent, suddenly everything just flows.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and also we all get along. I think that's the other thing. Like, there's so much respect for each other in the cast and in the creatives, and obviously we were all friends first too. So there's such an element of, like, we're all enjoying the process the whole way through. Mm. So it doesn't feel, like Logan said, as daunting as it initially was. And I think also it's kind of proven that, and this goes for all of, like, the artistic endeavors that everyone kind of wants to plunge into. It's like, just jump, like, just do it. And if you fail, you fail. And it would mean, hey, like, buy tickets, like, that'd be great, please. But, you know, at the same time, it's like, we're going into it with this idea of we're getting an experience out of this.
Absolutely.
And it's fun and we enjoy it. And if it doesn't sell as well as we hope, or, you know, if there's learnings to be taken, we'll do that and we'll pivot and stuff. But the point is that we're trying, you know, doing it.
Yeah, I think one of the other really interesting things, like, to come of it, kind of on that idea of learning that things can just kind of be done, is we've had quite a few, like, directors and people who are, like, pretty deep in New Zealand's musical theatre industry send us direct messages on Instagram asking us for help and instructions for how they can get rights to musicals. And they didn't realise that you can just go on the MTI website, make an application and submit it, and they'll get back to you, and you don't need all of these, like, credentials or experience for them to talk to you. You just have to send an email, you know. And I think a lot of people don't realize that these things are slightly less out of reach than they think they are.
We get paralyzed with, like, you know, preparation anxiety, right? And it's like, oh, but I'm not ready and I don't have the skill yet.
And again, involve those experts. So you'd reach out to your MTIs or Origin and go, hey guys, this is what we're thinking of pitching, and they're really good at coming back going, well, you can do it, but here's the restraints, or you need to watch this time of the year because it's touring or whatever. You know, use those experts. Jack, what's it like directing just a 2-person show? And you've got two casts of two, is that right?
Yes, we have an orange cast and we have a blue cast.
Right.
Colour themed things nicely. It's a really fun experience because you get to just focus on them. Like, when you direct, like, a bigger show like your Addams Family with your 200 teenagers that you have auditioned, you kind of have to look at, like, the big picture and have sort of, like, these blinders where you can see every single part of the stage, and you're having to look at what is that person over there doing, are they standing, like, what angle are they at, and all that sort of thing. But when you've got only two actors, and in some numbers it's just the one person, you can just sort of focus and hone in on that one person, and you can kind of, like, watch their performance under a bit of a microscope. So what little details can we add? What little things can we connect from the beginning of the show to the end of the show? What sort of things can link?
But it's also a different pressure because
absolutely,
when you do have hundreds on stage, there's lots of things happening, so it's a little bit easier for audience to spot something. Mm-hmm. When it's one, it's all eyes on you. So you as a director have got to make sure there's something for the audience to hook into second on one person.
It adds the pressure on the actor because they're like, I have to carry this moment themselves. So you have to support the actor the best they possibly can to get them prepared and get them ready for this is the sort of story that you're having to tell. But with Rose, Logan, Grace and Chris, it's just been dynamic to see the choices that they have made. I haven't had to, like, say, I want you to do it this particular way. It's, we're going to play in these areas of the stage, and this is the sort of vibe I want you to give me. Show me what you've got. And if I like it, then we'll stick with it. But if it's something that we need to tweak, we'll tweak. I introduced the word scooch
today. Yes.
Scooch. I've started using, like, I want a little bit more confidence, or scooch more confidence. I don't know where the word scooch came, but I feel like it works really, really well because everyone I've told about it has been like,
too much.
Yeah, I get the understanding of a metric scooch.
Yeah, more than a little, but not a lot.
Yeah, that's
it.
Yeah.
That's
it.
A scooch.
All right.
So, because, Logan, you're very experimental and you had this vision to have the play be a little bit different. Now, in both the casts, so the orange and the blue, do you let the other cast have a little bit freedom, and so you see both shows, but you'll see just a little bit different and be open to that? And then does that help you then maybe massage what you're doing with the blue cast?
Yeah, I really like that both casts are able to bring a different flair and flavor to the characters. And I think, like, one of the things we've been working on with the direction is making sure that for blocking purposes and lights, we're always in the same place, but allowing ourselves within that, because we're all going to approach characters and interpret characters differently, within that to make our own sort of character choices. Because I've always really felt that the character choices that the actor can, like, identify with are always going to read stronger to the audience than the character choice they're purely doing because their alt does, right? And in that, I've always thought, although I think there's still a lot of stealing that happens, and I think one of the reasons why I was so excited to bring Chris McCrae on board, who's someone I very deeply respect. He was one of my lecturers at university, and taught me singing for a little bit at university as well. I was really excited to bring him on board because it felt like this opportunity to watch him do it and then steal the things from his performance that I thought, oh, yeah, yeah, I can see my Jamie doing that, that, and that. But I'm going to do that a little differently. And, you know, he'll do the same thing where I'll make a choice, I'll give an offer, and he'll be like, oh, yeah, I should have been doing that the whole time, you know. And we can, like, steal and pass these ideas back and forth, you know. And I think that's a really beautiful addition to the creative process, to have another person there that you can, like, do it alongside.
Another thing about Chris is this is his fourth time doing this show. And he's done it two times as an actor and one time as a director. And some of my most favorite moments of rehearsals is when we were blocking it and he goes, oh, you're going to do it this way. Oh, that's cool. I didn't think to do it that way. And we're like,
Throwing the dancers in would add something for
us.
Time for a music break now, and tell us about the song Summer in Ohio. My daughter loves singing this at auditions, and every pianist hates her for it.
Oh, it sucks. Yeah, it's the best
it's a tough song.
It is an amazing song, and it's so fun to do because it's just high camp. It really reminds, we were talking about it in rehearsals, it really reminds me of Rose's Turn from Gypsy in some ways. And I love that song. That's one of my favorite in the music theater canon. So this is very fun to play with and just be like stupid, like dramatic to the point of stupid with it. But it is absolutely horrible to say.
It's a marathon. You get like 3/4 through the song and I'm like,
you can see me and Grace sweating. We're like sweating.
You can do it.
You're doing so good.
So close.
But it's really fun and it's been fun to like try and master it. So yeah.
Brilliant. All right, let's take a listen to A Summer in Ohio.
I could lease a villa in Seville, but it wouldn't be as nice as the summer in Ohio with a gay midget named Carl playing Tevye and Porgy. I could wander Paris after dark, take a carriage ride through Central Park, but it wouldn't be as nice as the summer in Ohio, where I'm sharing a room with a former stripper and her snake, Wayne. I could have a satchel full of dollar bills, cures for all the nation's ills, pills to make a lion purr. I could be in line to be the British queen, look like I was 17. I could shove an ice pick in my eye. I could eat some fish from last July, but it wouldn't be as awful as a summer in Ohio without cable, hot water, Vietnamese food, or you. I saw your book at a Target in Kentucky under a sign that said new and recommended. I stole a look at your picture on the inside sleeve and then I couldn't leave. Richard, who was with me, got uncharacteristically quiet. He said, all things considered, I guess you don't have to buy it. So I smile like Mona Lisa and I lay my visa down.
can't wait to see you sing that, Rose. I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to it. I'll bring you Jamie. You can come and watch. Now, I know when I produce theatre, I rope in all the family and friends because that's the easiest way, and they're all supportive. Have you roped in your family and friends? Are they helping on the show, backstage, front of house? What's happening? Who have you got?
Oh, yes. I've roped in both my siblings. My sister, Pearl, is an incredible dancer, and she's genuinely the most incredible choreographer I've ever met in my life as well. She just sees it and she gets it, and she also loves playing with crazy ideas, so like Logan's a great person for her to bounce off. So she's been choreographing the show and she's dancing in it as well, and her and Jack have been working so well together too.
Yeah, again, it's like give her a sentence of like, this is the vibe I want for, and she's like, oh, okay, yep, I've got an idea, and then just create something, and I'm like, I don't even know how I would have started to come up with any of that, but I love it.
That's why it's a team.
It's so good.
And my brother's dancing in it as well, and doing a really hilarious Wayne the Snake stripper moment in that Summer in Ohio. So it's all good fun. So that's kind of been like all the Stratton siblings are in it. And Jack's got his partner in it.
Yeah, we knew instantly that we were like, we're going to need someone who is going to be able to rein us all in as a superstar stage manager. So we got Carlin involved in on that. She's also helping organize all of the costumes.
Brilliant.
We have had extensive conversations in the car driving all around Auckland talking about, so what if this character wore this costume at this part of the show? And I'm like, yep, because I'm driving and I'm trying to do multiple things at the time. I'm like, I think that'll work. She's like, cool, I'll note that down.
We couldn't do this show without Carlin. She's genuinely the most competent person I know.
She just gets things done. That's the thing. You ask her to do something and it'll be done within the next day.
Yeah.
Like I mentioned before, she's also dabbling in some prop making as well. Mm. Like we mentioned before, Jamie is an author. So she was like, I'm going to make the book. And we were like, what do you mean you're going to make the book? She's like, I'm going to create the entire cover of the book on this website. So we actually have books of the from the show, and they look really,
Flight
really
of the
good.
Darkness by Jamie Wallerstein.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
And talk us through your music. You've got live music?
Yeah, we have a live band, music directed by Logan Hunt, so we've got two Logans involved in the show. We've got a string section, two cellos, violin, and then there's two guitars, acoustic and bass guitar, as well as Logan Hunt on keys and some shoulder conducting. The musicians behind them, yeah.
Love it.
Yeah, and they've been rehearsing in our living room, which is iconic. Like, we're just walking through the house and we go into the living room and there's a full string section and we're like, this is so cool.
I bet your neighbors love you.
Oh, they hate us.
it was so funny because I was there for a rehearsal a week or so ago, and I was just out the front getting some air because I was just getting a break, and I just see this person like walking past listening to the music and just like staring at the house. What is happening? And I just like, yeah, hello.
It's like one room there's singing, scream belting, yeah. Like one room there's like keys, the other one's a string. It's so fun. It's so good.
Fantastic. What are you hoping audiences will take away? So when they walk out, we've hidden our little Kick Arts microphone in your foyer at Bum House. What are you hoping they're going to be saying about the show?
I hope that audiences come watch the show and then analyze what's going on stage and come out of it understanding how both of the characters led to the downfall of that relationship. And I think that everyone kind of has something they can take away from it in regards to, say, how they approach relationships that they can learn about themselves by through watching that. And that's kind of what I hope people take away from it. And other than that, I just hope people leave being very entertained.
Yeah, pretty much.
Same, yeah. Jack, from a directing point of view?
Honestly, that's pretty on the money, because again, we've had this conversation of like, this is not a black and white story. This is a story heavily in the gray of like, you don't really want one character to come off as the villain. So it's finding the way of how both characters can have this empathetic arc so that when the audience leaves, they're like, oh, that is a relationship that just did not work. And it's no one's fault. It's just, it wasn't meant to be. Yeah. It could have, but there were just things that happen in your life that just say, you know what, this isn't, working.
Yeah, fair enough. And has this put you off? What have you got coming up later in the year? Doing any other shows,
so far
producing?
It hasn't.
Yeah, so far it hasn't. We've got a few projects lined up for the rest of this year. We're collabing with Perform NZ for a teenage musical that we'll be producing and directing in the middle of the year, June, July, which we'll be putting out audition notices and sign-ups for very soon. And we also have a booking for a project which is currently tightly under wraps at Q Theatre in October that we will be announcing and putting up audition notices for very soon as well.
It's going to be a huge season, so we're already like stressed, but it's going to be fun. Like, it's going to be so cool.
It's going to be a big year.
Oh, you'll have to come back and talk to us when you release it.
Yes.
Flick us the email. All right, where can people go to get tickets and come and support your wonderful work?
So come and see some unhinged reels and like production updates and all that stuff on our Instagram, which is The Last 5 Years NZ. And on there, there's also a link to the ticket website, but you can also go straight to the Pump House Theatre's website, which is www.pumphouse.co.nz. And you can search up The Last 5 Years. It's also on the What's On page there. And book your tickets.
20th to the 27th of February. Great restaurant out the front. You can go and have some amazing food beforehand as well and make a night of it.
Oh, yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming in on a Sunday night so close to opening. Have a fantastic season. We look forward. We'll be out there to support you and can't wait to come and see it. Go well.
Oh,
thank you so much for having us.
All good. And now we're going to cross over to the States to have a quick catch-up with Emma.
Well, kia ora whānau. It's Emma here. I'm currently sitting in Hotel Edison, just off Times Square. I'm over here, as some of you have heard, for Travel Gang's Kiwi All-Stars. Now, what is that? Well, we are an auditioned performance troupe. Auditions take place annually at the Junior Theatre Festival in Auckland, and students are selected to travel to either America, to JTF West or Atlanta, or to go to JTF Europe, and that happens in May each year, Atlanta and West are in January. And the kids are selected 18 months in advance, which gives them plenty of time to fundraise the funds required. So the Kiwis this year, 26 kids and some family and friends, left Auckland on Thursday. We were on the New York flight, NZ2, so the direct flight from Auckland to New York. And I was kind of dreading it, but I have to say, it was actually fantastic. Up, and then 15 and a half hours later, down. And, you know, dinner service, your quick snack, and then breakfast. And we arrived here. We did have a long wait in immigration, but we got through. And then it was a quick stop on 8th Ave to find some pizza, say hello to Times Square, and then everyone was off in bed. Yesterday was day one, officially. Well, day two of the tour. And we started with the Empire State Building, then on to Grand Central Station, then into Central Park for a bit of ice skating before we headed to our first Broadway show, which was Hell's Kitchen. No, nothing to do with Gordon Ramsay. In fact, it's the music of Alicia Keys. And it's kind of a semi-biographical, I hear, but a story about a young girl and her relationship with her family and kind of what it means to be a teenage girl, really. And then we got to sit with some of the cast and crew after the show for a question and answer. Today, the kids are spending their first day in studio with the casting process for their 15-minute adjudication, which they'll be taking to Junior Theatre Festival in Sacramento next week. They're doing a 15-minute adjudication from Mean Girls Junior, which is super exciting, as that particular show is not currently available to be performed in New Zealand. So the kids are getting an opportunity to do something that they wouldn't normally get. They're working with the amazing Rob Rakiki, writer of Percy Jackson's Lightning Thief musical, as their musical director. Dr. Shane Branston from Travel Gang is directing them. And their choreographer is Max Gonzalez, who has been in a national tour of Mean Girls, as well as having been in Music Man with Hugh Jackman. So they're working with an exceptional team, and I can catch you up more on that next week. So what's in store for us for the rest of the trip until I speak to you next week? Well, we've got until Wednesday here in New York City. The students have got 3 more days in the studio to learn their piece. We've got a group outing to see the Outsiders musical. The kids have got a Broadway workshop. And other than that, it's lots of sightseeing, lots of doing. I'm actually off to see Two Strangers Carrying a Cake this afternoon. And then tonight I'm seeing Death Becomes Her. So I will have reviews of those for you next week. In the meantime, though, if you have a young performer aged 10 to 18, check out Junior Theatre Festival New Zealand. We happen every year, and in fact this year it's our 10th year. It happens at Labour Weekend, and in the week leading up to it we do our pilot program, which is where we get to workshop a yet-to-be-released Broadway musical. Groups doing Broadway junior shows across the motu are invited to bring a group to the festival to be adjudicated by international teaching artists and practitioners and have a weekend of musical fun. Check out juniortheatrefestival.nz. Otherwise, it's pretty cold here in New York. Today is the coldest day they reckon they've had here in 9 years. It's minus 16 degrees. It is absolutely freezing. The minute you walk outside, the wind chill is god-awful. So I'm going to be busy staying warm, and I hope that you're enjoying the sunshine in Aotearoa. And until next week, ka kite.
Thanks, Emma. And oh my goodness, Kristen, I'm so jealous. That list of shows. But you know what I love the most? The kids get to meet the cast afterwards and have those Q&As. How cool is that?
That is so inspiring. And I'm not even surprised that that is a beautifully curated trip of seeing some of the icons, but then going and seeing the beautiful art, like all the shows.
Yeah. She needs to organize a seniors junior festival, you know, like so that we could go on a curated trip with her. That would be cool.
And picking shows that that aren't the big blockbusters. Think, well, besides Death Becomes Her, I think that one is yeah, pretty popular, but some really some interesting theater that we really wouldn't think about, and being led by someone like Emma who could then curate us to go see
so
some
cool
amazing stuff.
I haven't heard of, what was it, Cake Down the Road or something?
That two was people new holding a cake?
Yeah, I haven't heard. That was a new one. Well, we're learning lots of things because we're now going to get naked in the trees, and we're jumping on the phone now to chat to Lisa about this amazing festival coming up. How are you tonight, Lisa?
Hi, thanks for having me on. Yes, very good, thank you.
Great.
So tell us about this festival. Tell us how many years it's been going on and how you started it, and really give us the lowdown. We want to know.
Okay, sure. I'll try and keep this as short as possible. So it's the second year that we're having the festival on the site that it is now. It's the third year in total. But yeah, it's definitely growing every year. It's across 100 acres, so it's quite big. But we have two main zones. So there's one called the village and one called the playground. And in the village, we run all sorts of workshops, and that's where you get food. And we have a lot of activities, and like a tattoo temple and a healer temple, all sorts of things, actually. And then in the playground, we have the main stage, because all the live music and workshops is in the village, and then we have the main stage with all the DJs in the playground, and we also have a rather large play space as well, which is for people that would like to connect a bit further. I don't know how much you want to delve into everything.
I just love that Lisa's been very PC, Kristen, because she's not naming some of these wonderful stage titles. Now, our previous guest got quite fascinated by some of the titles.
You had to take the paper away from him.
Yeah.
Because it is very, it's really interesting. And so it's a family friendly event, is that? Or is it?
No, it's not.
It's adults only.
It's 18 only.
Okay,
yeah,
that's good.
Did you read the title of this?
I just want to make sure.
Yeah.
Good
clarity.
To be open.
Good clarity.
Yet, okay, so it is a, so it's for adults. And how did you come up with this? Like, what was the, what's the origin story on this? I am fascinated.
So I actually originally started all of this with Naked Dinners, and that was because I personally used to get social anxiety at dinners, and I was wondering how to get around that. Mm. And one of the ways that I thought people overcome anxiety in those spaces is if you're giving a speech, you would imagine the audience naked. So 100%. I was like, well, maybe the same would apply if I just did that to the dinner table, but did it literally. And so I started those. I was doing them every 3 weeks. They were selling out every 3 weeks, and they got bigger, and then performances were in between the courses. And then I was trying to work out how people could have the same results, but with a larger audience. And that was when I moved from doing dinners to doing what's now called the Undie Party. And I still run those. Those run throughout the year. And that's when you get anything. The last one I did was actually 1,000 people. And it's everyone's in underwear, but in a certain theme. And so the only rule is that your genitals have to be covered, and it's completely non-sexual. So it's to keep everyone safe.
Yeah.
You don't know it's different brilliant. People's experience levels. So it's just a very creative event where a lot of people just meet new friends, are very sort of open-minded, very creative people. And then from there, it was sort of a natural progression, but it's also I start a new event when I have a question about something. And if I have a question, I speak to a few people, and then they also have questions around the same area. That's when I feel like it's a good time to start a new event. And that's when I brought Pleasure along, which is now the sexual element of the Naked. The Naked World is actually the name of the brand that umbrellas all of this.
Right.
And so we have, so under the Naked World is now three events, which is the festival, Naked in the Trees, the Undie Party, which is completely non-sexual, and Pleasure, which is sexual. And so it just gives a space for everyone to be able to talk to each other and not feel judged, and also be able to explore things with one another in a safe environment. And the festival was actually how I actually did the first festival to test out whether the audience would mind having a sexual element brought into the brand. So it was before I started Pleasure. Mm. So I put a play space. And in the first festival, the play space was quite literally two gazebos put together. And it was just there to see if people would use it. And it was so busy. And no one seemed to mind that there was now this sexual element that was very much kept to one area of the event. But the first festival was very small. It was just me learning how to run a festival. So I just did all the elements of a festival.
Nice.
And then spent a year and a half looking for land and finally found this absolutely stunning piece of land down in Tamaranui, or just outside of it. And yeah, that's where we now have Naked in the Trees, and the play space is now 210 square meters. So it's a rather large play space. and about 70, 80 people use it at any one time.
And so, go ahead, sorry. Yeah.
I can talk for hours on it.
Yeah, well, it's fascinating. It brings up so many questions. So it's a festival for the curious. Now, if someone mm-hmm. didn't want to be so experimental, how far away, so we could tell our listeners, well, if you're in the village, you really can stay there and, you know, feel safe. And so how far apart mm-hmm. are these two areas?
So there's actually a river in between that you need to cross. So we build four bridges across the river. There's a really big, massive waterfall as well. So it's a really beautiful piece of land. And the village is, complete. It's we actually do ask all guests to keep any sexual activity to the pleasure tent. And that means that because a lot of people are of different experience levels, and they're also there for quite a few reasons, because there's a lot else that happens.
Mm.
Some people are there for music. Some people are there for the workshops. Some people are there for just the activities and going to the massage, like getting a massage and having a tattoo and things like that, all these other things. Or they might just be fire dancers. There are lots of other things. So I do design it so you very much can curate your own journey, and you can keep to the areas that you would like to keep to, and you definitely don't need to go into areas that you don't want to. They're all separate. So, yeah. We do, one thing I add is we do actually have a separate wristband for people that have had, they've been consent checked.
Mm.
So before they arrive at the festival. So everyone, all the guests are able to apply for a free pass online. And it just means that they've gone through all of our consent rules, and then they've answered a number of questions. We've also then ID checked them and things like that as well.
Cool.
So then they get a different wristband coming in, and that means that they're allowed into the pleasure tent. So we have a huge team of consent guardians that look after that space, and yeah, it just keeps it that we found that the rules are too long to say all of them and to get everyone to vocal those rules in when they're on site, because when you're on site, you're already in quite a high adrenaline space, and absorbing information at that point is quite a lot to ask of someone. So, yeah, we do everything in advance.
And do people literally come and camp there for the days?
It's a four-day festival. So
yes, most of them full camping site as well, yeah.
Yeah. We have general camping, which is across the river from the festival, from the village. So it's a really nice, beautiful view over the village. We have glamping, we have pre-pitched tents, and then we also have vehicle camping, which means that you can sleep in your van or park and sleep next to your tent. Park next to your tent.
Oh, amazing. Cool. Now, if someone's coming for the first time and they just want to stick in the village, what is one thing that you say you must do to really kind of get a feel for it, to get, you know, warm themselves up to Naked in the Trees? Like, what would you say this is not to be missed? One or two of the things?
I would say go to Spill the Tea Party, which is, it's around the big grandfather tree that's in the village. And the idea of that event is to actually get people to talk to one another. So it's a really easy way of meeting other people that are at the festival. We do also have things like a queer hour, which happens at 5 o'clock every day. There's ecstatic dancing. So there's loads of other things. Like, we have a sound journey every morning, and there's yoga every morning. There's also like more fun events that are kind of like learning how to lap dance or erotic reading, or I think we've got something like 35 workshops. So there's like quite a few to go through. Yeah, there's lots of ways that we curate meeting one another. So it's a nice, easy, and welcoming event.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Now, what is your vision for this? Like, what's your big dream? Like, your big, like, if I had a big audacious goal, this is what it would be for Naked in the Trees.
Well, actually, my big one at the moment is I really want to make the village into a village. So, you know how you would have a post office and you would have, like the corner store and a bank and things like this, so that people can send postcards to one another and just have like fun ways of sort of operating a village. And actually, I would love to run a really big naked dinner as well as our sort of big joining thing all together. So there's lots of sort of fun, bigger plans that we'll do for the future.
And is it hard to get artists or artisans to come and join the festival? Like, how do you curate them?
Not at all. I had to close submissions because the DJs, because I run parties throughout the year, I actually know enough DJs to more than do twice the lineup. There are so many brilliant DJs in New Zealand.
Yeah, 100%.
And then for the workshops, if I had to go out and find these workshops, that would actually be really difficult. But all of them come to me. So, I had to close submissions because we had too many. And I quite literally can't. I've got four spaces that we can do workshops in, and I can't fit any more in. Most of them run for an hour. A few of them run for an hour and a half. And we try and keep it that length because, again, there's a lot going on. So it's very occasional workshop will run longer than that. But yeah, they're back to back, so you can pick which one you want to go to at any time.
Amazing. All right, so now tell us the date and the email or the web address that people can get more information.
Yeah, sure. So the dates are the 13th to the 16th of February, so it's in a couple of weeks. And the best place to go online is the website, which is nakedinthetrees.co.nz. And then if you want to go on Instagram, where you can find sort of everything about all the events, that's thenaked.world on Instagram.
Amazing. Well, good luck with the festival. We look forward to hearing how it goes.
Yeah, have a fantastic event. And if you've got any of those dinner plans anywhere, let us know. Make sure you tell Kick Art so we can get that word out whenever that's popping up during the year.
I definitely will. Okay, thank you so much.
Thanks, Lisa. Have a great festival.
Thank you. Bye.
Cheers. Now, Teeks this week released their track Landslide, and it's got a beautiful recording. It was recorded live at the Auckland Town Hall. You can check it out on YouTube, but let's take a listen. Live at the Auckland Town Hall. It's a beautiful, simple video, but it worked, didn't it?
It did. It's so surreal and just so poignant. Perfect just to lay back and enjoy.
Yeah. And the Town Hall has just beautiful acoustics. And, of course, it's got the pipe organ. And that piano he's playing, I've had the privilege of playing myself. It's just a beautiful space to perform in.
It's always an experience, no matter what I see there, whether it's a concert or, you know, something like even a party, like a company party.
Yeah.
There's just, it sets the stage for every kind of moment.
Mm. Now, we had a little bit of fortuitous luck in the last couple of weeks because a wonderful publisher contacted us and said, look, I've got this overseas author who would just love to chat to you here in New Zealand, but can we make the time zones work for an interview because they are over in the States. And, of course, who's over in the States at the moment? But Emma, so we sent her off to do a quick catch-up with this fabulous author. Here it is.
Well, as you know, listeners, I'm currently sitting in New York, and it's a great joy to actually be able to catch up with someone who's also in the United States. Welcome to Kick-Arts, RL. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
No worries at all. So whereabouts in America are you based?
I am in Colorado. I'm right next to the Rocky Mountains. It's really beautiful here. But I grew up in New York. So I grew up in where you are now.
Great. And tell us a little bit about your backstory. Have you always been a writer? Was this something that you imagined yourself doing when you were a teenager?
I grew up wanting to be a writer. I think when I was 6 years old, I wrote my first book. It was a crayon and staples affair. And it was called Unga and the Frog. And Unga was an extraterrestrial, and the frog was a frog. So I have wanted to be a writer for a very long time, but my path was not straight. I tried to become a writer in my 20s, and I sent out some really terrible stories, really terrible. But I didn't know they were terrible at the time. I thought they were really brilliant. And I sent them to the New Yorker. I mean, I sent them to the top magazines, thinking they were going to discover me, embrace me, hail me. didn't happen, of course. I got a lot of rejections. And I got discouraged. I got so discouraged that I stopped writing. I went to law school. And I spent really the middle part of my life as a lawyer. But there was a little voice in the back of my head saying, you know, you had a dream. You still have that dream. You want to do this. You don't want your whole life to go by without trying again. And when I was about 40, I started again. And so I'm dating myself a little bit because that was quite a while ago. And I started again. I started writing every day. I took classes, lots of classes. There's a great writing school in Denver, which isn't too far from where I am. And I took all kinds of fiction writing workshops and even essay writing workshops and even some poetry classes. And I just kept at it day after day after day until finally those stories, you know, magazines started to want them. And then my first book was a collection of those stories. And since then, I've written two novels.
So what do you think was the difference maybe between your writing in your 20s to your writing in your 40s?
What a great question. I've never thought about that. I mean, I just think writing is the kind of craft that some people think, if you've never done it, you think, oh, I have a book in me. I'm going to write a book. I have a great idea. I'm going to write a book. But you don't realize how much craft there is to writing and how difficult it is to write something compelling or beautiful or lyrical. You know, it's really hard. No matter what genre you want to write in, whether you want to write thrillers or mysteries or general fiction books, those are all really hard. You know, I'm not a, you know, I am a lawyer, and I can say, and I went to law school for 3 years, writing is harder than being a lawyer. It is. It takes more than 3 years to learn. Being a lawyer takes more than 3 years to learn to do it well, too. But it really takes many years of practicing every aspect of it, learning how to write a plot, learning how to, you know, to shape that pacing that goes into a plot, the surprises that come along with a plot, learning how to develop characters so that they're not all good, not all bad, interesting. You know, I think if one of the things I can remember from when I was first starting, I think my characters were very black and white.
Right.
I think I had villains and heroes. And I didn't understand. And you know, that's something I think as you get older, you understand better that most of us humans, I wouldn't, not all, but most of us humans have a good, healthy dose of good and bad in us. We have a lot of good instincts and a lot of troublesome instincts. And we wrestle with them. And I feel like good fiction, in good fiction, that's what we see. We see characters wrestling with those in the context of a compelling plot.
What makes you, if you pick up a book, what makes you keep reading it?
Oh, I love that question. You know, for me, it's voice. I know it's different things for different people. For me, it's voice. For me, I am reading that book and I'm hearing that author's voice and I just want to listen to them for hours. Maybe because it's a little funny, like I love funny books. So maybe because it's a little funny, or maybe right on that first page, they pose a question or the character, like some question is posed that immediately hooks my, like it's suspenseful. I want to know what's going to happen, right? Or it presents a situation that's so unusual that I'm I'm kind of taken aback, and I want to watch almost like you would, you know, want to watch anything that you saw in real life that was so strange, right? And so, but I do think for me, it's a voice, that storytelling voice that is so unique to the author. You know, sometimes people say, oh, there's only so many stories. And to some degree, that's true, right? Although every writer puts their own twist on them, but it's also their voice. Like every writer's voice is completely unique.
So do you have any go-to authors that the minute you hear a book's coming out, you're lining up at Barnes & Noble or you're on Amazon ordering it?
I have many, many like that. I mean, I recently, I've read a couple of James McBride's books. He wrote The Heaven and Earth Grocery Store. And what I love about his books, and another one I just want to mention, he wrote Deacon King Kong. So I read both of those. And both of them are about really heavy subjects, really serious subjects. One is about racism in the United States in the 1930s, so a really serious subject. And one's about heroin epidemics in the 1960s in Brooklyn. And so really heavy topics, right? He's very funny. And I learned from him that you can still inject humor into a book even when you're writing about a really serious subject. Not only can you, but it's the reader appreciates it. Because yeah. If you're writing about a really heavy subject, it's hard, right? You're almost, like they say when you're reading a book, it's almost like you're really experiencing that. That your imagination, your brain doesn't know the difference. And so it's stressful. And that laughter, that humor gives you a release. And I try to do that in my books, but I felt like he gave me permission. His books are so good and they're dealing with such serious, important subjects, but he's also really funny that it gave me permission to be funny in my books, even if I'm writing about serious subjects. The other thing I'll say about that is he's not Pollyanna. They don't have Hollywood endings, but he also, there's some hope in the endings of his book. And I learned that from him too. Even again, if you're writing about a subject that, I mean, there's nothing happy about racism in the 1930s in the United States, right? You can't possibly think that. But he has characters and he creates stories where there's still some hope. And I feel like for the reader, and I know for myself as a reader, when I leave a book that I've spent 7 hours or 9 hours with, or maybe 2 weeks or a week with, I want a little hope too. Mm. You know, I want to take away a lot of things, but one of the things is some hope. I don't want to leave just with a really grim ending. I remember, I don't want to give away the ending of this book though, so now I'm not going to mention it. But I remember a really good book I read. I loved it. If I'm not mistaken, yes, it was an Irish writer, 600-page book. So it took me a little while to read it, a novel. I thought it was brilliant. But it had a really depressing ending. And he had a choice at the end with how to end it. I could tell. As a writer, I could tell. But as a reader, I could tell. And he went for the depressing ending. And I was sad about that. It was hard. You know, it was hard to finish the book. So again, that aspect of hope. You know, Bonnie Garmus, I don't know if you've read Lessons in Chemistry. So another book, it's about sexism and feminism, but in the 1950s in the United States. And hilarious book, but a serious subject. And not, she doesn't take it lightly. It's just that she happens to be a very funny person and writer. And so it's just a marvelous read. I mean, you enjoy it so much and you take something away from it.
Fabulous. So, I mean, you're demonstrating that you know, that whole thing of, and I think this is what young writers maybe can think about. Like, you need to read other people's books. You need to take the time to reflect. What do you like? What don't you like? And then I suppose it's learning how to craft that into your own work.
Absolutely. Right. I mean, I think that's so true. I mean, I think a lot of writers would read anyway because a lot of us become writers because we feel like books are such a gift and we want to be able to create that gift. That certainly was part of my desire, right? I mean, I grew up with books. My mother would read these fat historical fiction novels and then she'd pass them down to me. And so you want to do that. But I absolutely agree with you that there's a way to read too. I mean, sometimes you're just lost in the story and that's wonderful. But as a writer, it's also really good to read noticing. Noticing what the writer that you are enjoying is doing. And that's sort of like a secondary gift in the book. Like, you get the great story, but you also get maybe a new tool for your toolbox, you know, a new technique that you can use.
Now tell me, the book that we're actually here to talk about. What kind of a writer was PJ Larkin?
Yes. So, you know, at the beginning, she tries to write funny novels. And those novels don't sell. We catch her right at the beginning of the book, and she hasn't sold two funny novels that she thought were funny and should sell, and her agent hasn't been able to sell them. And now she's finished a novel that's quite different for her because it's based on something hard that happened to her sister. So now she's written kind of maybe not a funny book, but a book that she thinks will be compelling. And yet on the opening day of the book, we find out her agent didn't manage to sell that either.
Crazy. So, are you allowed to tell us what she does about that? Or is that giving PJ's story away?
I think it's okay because it's right at the beginning. So what she does about it, that very same day, she's so sad, so depressed that three of her books haven't sold. Her best friend tells her, hey, I heard that a book just like yours, this new one, sold for $1 million. And she goes and looks up, just all she looks up is the sale notice of this book. So she sees two sentences of what it's about. And then she goes on social media and she accuses the writer of that book of stealing her story. And it so happens that the writer of that book is an editor that her agent sent her book to.
Wow. So does this mean it's kind of... What genre would you put this book under? It sounds like it's got a little bit of mystery, a little bit of...
You know, I'm not sure if it's a mystery because we find out pretty early what each of them did. It's more of a, I don't know, a conundrum or a where the reader has to decide who's wrong. And it's not clear cut once we know what she did and what he did. Right? It's not really clear cut. So it's more almost of an ethical dilemma, although the book itself, I hope, is funny. And I'd put it in the categories of either general fiction or literary fiction or book club fiction, because it really raises a lot of issues that I think, and I've noticed already as readers have been reading it, that readers love to fight about.
Love it. So where did the inspiration or the Nass come to pick up this is or to create this book?
Yeah, so while I was, you know, working on other things, I would do something that I think a few writers do, at least a few that I know. I would go on social media and get distracted, right? I would spend too much time on Twitter and too much time on Facebook and Instagram. And but while I was on those sites, I actually saw writers getting accused of a lot of different things. Sometimes they were accused of writing about sometimes they're accused of plagiarism. And in fact, in one case, this woman that was accused had not plagiarized. But of course, by the time the truth comes out, quite often so many people have jumped on the bandwagon to attack, right, this kind of cancel culture, to attack the person who's being accused because it makes them angry. People like to get angry on social media. So I saw that. But I also saw writers being attacked for all kinds of reasons. Sometimes someone thought, oh, you shouldn't be writing this book because maybe this didn't happen to you. You don't have personal experience with it. So you shouldn't be writing about it, or I don't like the way you're writing about it. And often these attacks came from people who'd only read a review or only read a blurb. They hadn't even read the whole book. Maybe the whole book wasn't even out yet. And here's the thing. I really feel like you shouldn't be allowed to attack a book if you haven't read it.
No.
How do you know? Yeah. There's too much nuance in the book. Like, you can't just summarize a book in a sentence, right, and really know what it's about or what point the author is trying to make or how nuanced the point is.
Yeah. Yeah. Crazy. So tell us a little bit about your writing process. How do you go about writing?
Sure. And so I'm what is known as a pantser, right? Because I fly by the seat of my pants. And my first draft, I am just telling myself a story. I don't have any notes usually. I don't have an outline. I just see where the story goes. It's a very messy way of outlining, right? As opposed to plotters. And there are some wonderful writers who are what we call plotters, where they plot everything out first. They have a full outline and then they just fill in the details while they're writing. I can't do it that way. I have to just sit at my desk, and that first draft takes a couple of months, if not a year, but usually a couple of months. I'd say like 6 months to write a draft. It's very messy. And by the time I get to the end, half of it doesn't make sense. But I start to have some general idea of what story I want to tell. And then I go and I start from the beginning and work to the end again, just once again, kind of, revising it, but it's almost not revising because I'm really writing whole swaths still at that point because I'm just figuring out what the story is.
Wow. Okay. And do you have a favorite place to write in? Like, do you have a go-to, I get comfy and I sit here and I write?
So I'm very lucky to have a home office, and I write, I'm in it now, and I write in my home office. But when I get stuck, I like to move to a different room, and I get stuck all the time. And that's because I feel like if there's a different kind of feedback into my eyes, it might jog something loose. I've written on cruise ships. You know, I've written certainly at residencies or retreats. But my favorite place, I think, is my office. And I like to show up on a very regular schedule, 8 or 9 in the morning every day, work for, you know, till lunch, a couple of hours. I feel like the muse will know where to find me if I show up regularly.
How fantastic. So, is the next, because this particular book has just recently launched. Have you got another one tracking along?
So I wrote a first draft, or maybe even more of a first draft of another one. And I wrote it, and then I got very busy with a complete fiction, this one. And it's been a little while. And so I'm sort of feeling like maybe I don't want to write that book. Sometimes events overtake a book.
Right.
And I'm not sure if in the last year or so, while I've been working so hard, you know, revising this one, putting this one out, doing publicity for this one, whether events have overtaken that book. The world looks a little different, especially in the United States. The world looks a little different right now.
Sure.
And so, all right, doesn't it? So I'm not sure that that's my primary concern, what I wrote that book about. And so I'm not sure. I'm going to return soon to writing, and I'll just see if, you know, I'll read that one through and see if it's something I want to work on, or I'll try something new. I like to take a little break between books and do something different. And right now I'm actually taking a free class online on Emily Dickinson, you know, just for something different, just to read a lot of her poetry. And I never really took that many poetry classes, and just to hear a teacher talk about it, and, you know, just to get some new, to kind of fill that artistic well again.
And I mean, like you said, you can always revisit if it's not the right time. Maybe it's something you revisit later on.
Absolutely.
Have any of your books ever thought, or do they lend to sequels? Like, are you someone that you've come up with a character you've been so attached to, you've thought, oh, they need a next outing?
I have thought about that. My first novel was called Other People's Pets, and there was a subplot involving an older couple. And I kind of think at the end of the book, he's in jail. I guess I'm giving a little bit away. He's in jail and she's not. And I kind of wonder if when he gets out, it might be time for them to get back together
and see
what happens. I think that would be a fun book to write. Isn't that funny? I really haven't thought about it much since you said it. It would be a totally different kind of book than Other People's Pets, which had nothing to do with that. Other People's Pets was about an animal empath who burgled houses. So very different.
Yeah.
But I think that absolutely might be fun. And there are some characters in A Complete Fiction, this new one, that people have said to me, would you write a sequel about these two characters? And that also makes me wonder, that might be nice to write another book about them. I've never done that, though, I will say. Like, I've never written a sequel. So I wonder what that's like. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's something to add to your basket.
Maybe.
Well, that's fantastic. So, this book, A Complete Fiction, is out now?
It is out now, and you can get it, you know, at all the independent bookstores in Australia and New Zealand. And you can get it straight from the publisher, which is Text Publishing. And you could just Google and find that. And if you're in the United States, you can get it from all the independent bookstores, which is always such a wonderful place to buy books from. And of course, you can get it from all the online stores, the big online stores as well.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, RL, for giving us some time to hear about your writing and things. And I mean, so interesting. I love the fact that we started the interview talking about likes and dislikes in writing, and then talking about a complete fiction. I feel like there's a really lovely circular kind of feeling there. And it makes me want to pick up a complete fiction and have a read for sure.
Well, if you do, I hope you enjoy it. And thank you so much for the interview.
No worries. Thank you.
I don't have a sunny disposition. I'm not known for being too amused. My demeanor's locked in one position. See my face. I'm enthused. Suddenly, however, I've been puzzled. Bunny rabbits make me want to cry. All my inhibitions have been muzzled, and I think I know why. I'm being pulled in a new direction, but I think I like it. I think I like it. I'm being pulled in a new direction. Through my painful pursuit, somehow birdies took root. All the things I detested, impossibly cute. God, what do I do? Mother always said, be kind to strangers. But she doesn't know what they destroy. I can feel the clear and present dangers when she learns that the boy has got me pulled in a new direction. But I think I like
that
it.
That was good, that was good.
I think I like it.
Do it again, do it again.
I'm being pulled in a new direction. And this feeling I know is impossible, so I'll confide that I've tried, but I can't let it go. It's disgustingly true. Dog with droopy faces, unicorns with dancing mice, sunrise in wide open spaces, Disney World, I'll go there twice. Butterflies and picnic lunches, bunches of chrysanthemums, lollipops and pillow fights, and Christmas Eve, sugar plums, string quartets and Gia pets, and afternoon banana splits, angels watching as I sleep, and Pavarotti's greatest hits. Have gone evolved in a new direction. If they keep insisting, I'll stop resisting. Just watch me fall in a new direction. I should stay in the dark, not obey every spark. But the boy has a bite better far than his bark. And you bet I'll find you. Do what's truly devil.
Pulled from the Addams Family, a song I heard many times today as we did our auditions for that. And thanks, Emma, for checking in with that fabulous author, RL. Great to have that international content.
That was amazing and such great insight into not just their book, but the process. And I'm so intrigued now.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, the Theatre List has just come in the nick of time with just one key thing that we want to remind you of. And that, of course, is Auckland's Shakespeare in the Park. It is still going through until the 14th of February. What a lovely Valentine's End romantic setting at the Pump House. You are?
I'm going to Much Ado About Nothing. I cannot wait next week.
Oh, great. Excellent. we will look forward to the review. So head to pumphouse.co.nz where you'll also find the details on the last 5 years that we talked about earlier in the show. And a reminder that ATC have got Murder on the Orient Express. They're doing lots of publicity, so you're going to want to get in quick. It's a limited return season, 7th of February to the 15th, and book at atc.co.nz. Well, that's all we've got time for this week. Thanks for filling in the seat once again.
Oh, I do my best.
Both of us will be back here next week while Emma can check in and tell us the next lot of shows. She's gone and seen. We will end with Tukia from the team called Hope. Have a wonderful week and make sure you
kick some art.
Same fix. So tired and so tired of trying to win time and it won't fit. But with you I feel it shift. So magnetized pulling you in. It's in your eyes under my skin. Baby, we've been on the same plane. You feel the same.
Sleep. We'll be going live, same time under the stars, saying blah, blah.